hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my countryman, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Just how long the rest of us can count and be free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You run down my country, man, you're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on LightResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, here's a letter I received from a prisoner in Florida. And by the name of Tony Doc Dupre, he says he's a veteran's son. And this is a rather interesting piece of information, which I said I'd pass on. The Church of Jesus Christ Christian needs webmasters, Germanic folk activists, to grievance representatives concerning the abuses of our elder folk in prison. Who should be separated from prison gangs for micromanagement. In existing institutions, the elderly institutions are marked in the Northwest Panhandle. Are needed in the Northwest Panhandle. The FDOC currently has only two institutions for inmates 50 and older. There's a waiting list that takes years. Meanwhile, the elderly people are being extorted, robbed, raped, beaten, stabbed, maimed, and murdered, etc. Life flight costs $22,000 per flight alone. Elders have more brittle bones, requiring more surgeries due to gang attacks. We also need PTSD treatments, post-traumatic stress disorder treatments. Gang violence in Florida prisons has jumped 100% since 2011. Florida prisons are now known as gangland. Elderly prisoners live in a hellish war zone. Classifying more institutions for 50 and older men will not cost 1 cent, but will save billions. Your contacts are needed to promote this suggestion. I think it's a good one. My local paper, one of the Canada's two national papers, the Globe and Mail, has a feature obituary section, and this was the obituaries. A woman named Neus Catala, a bitter looking old woman, is described simply as an anti-fascist, died at age 103, and she fought against the nationalists in Spain. She took a group of orphans near the end of the Spanish Civil War, 1939, to cross the Pyrenees to France, where she married a Frenchman. And most of her biography is not of particular interest, but what I did find interesting was this. With the advent of the Spanish Civil War in 1936, and she'd be 20 then, she became active within the communist youth group in Catalonia and moved to Barcelona. Okay, and she and her French husband, by the name of Roger, joined the French resistance. Now, you've got to understand, the French resistance has a rather benign name or reputation today. It was not benign. The French resistance were communists, and it was heavily dominated by communists, and to the extent they managed to latch on to the Allied victory in 1944 and so on, when the Allies, after Normandy, invaded France and drove the Germans out, the resistance took on quite an importance. That's important to realize, though, that it was communist dominated, and in fact, many of the brutal reprisals that took place after the war, where women who had been girlfriends to German officers were beaten and or usually had their heads shaved and were paraded down the street, there were thousands of summary executions of alleged collaborators, as people who fought on the wrong side. Much of this is instigated by the hardcore communists in the Communist Party, which brings me back to the person who died, Neus Catala, and it says that when she was part of the resistance, it was eventually caught and sent to a German prison in Flossenbürg in Bavaria, where she was to work in an arms factory. We used sabotage to produce about 10 million faulty bullets and thousands of unusable artillery shells, she said in a 2013 interview with the Spanish Trade Union magazine. We threw everything into the production line, flies, cockroaches, oil, our own spit. Just a nasty piece of work, isn't she? Furious that General Franco had not been overthrown, this is in 1945, along with Hitler and Benito Mussolini, Neus Catala resumed her anti-fascist work, acting as a messenger for the Spanish Communist Party's underground network. A lifelong communist, and in that sense, it was entirely predictable that she would be an anti-fascist. Here is an example of the saying sometimes of a travel agent friend of mine, even the good guys are bad. And it's an article with a rather encouraging title, On Campus Unpopular Views Also Deserve a Platform, written by Amy Lai, L-A-I, Chinese obviously. Lawyer and author of The Right to Parody and a book on free speech in higher education, She's under contract with the University of Michigan Press. Her essay begins, or her article begins rather, hopefully. Over the past few years, various speakers have had engagements canceled on university campuses in an effort to silence their unpopular views. Known as deplatforming, this is mostly championed by university administrators, academics, and students. At other times, even people outside the university participate in such campaigns who basically deny a platform to somebody. She goes on to quote John Stuart Mill on the idea of the marketplace of ideas. Then she gets, she says something which she will repeat later in her article, although she opposes deplatforming people. Well, some people. What does she say, though? Provided that their talks do not constitute hate speech or harassment, are conducted respectfully and include free-flowing question and answer sessions, a marketplace of ideas benefiting both speaker and listeners would be facilitated. Now, that actually contains a number of exceptions or caveats. Provided that the talks of the controversial speakers do not constitute hate speech. Well, that's a problem. What is hate speech? To radical feminists, it's any questioning of the feminist agenda. It is, for instance, the assertion that men and women are different, have different roles. Oh, no, men and women are the same. Well, that's what they believe. The immigration lobby, any questioning of the wholesale invasion that's being facilitated under the guise of immigration would be considered hate speech. To the increasingly militant transgender lobby, any questioning of the state of transgenderism. Is it a reality, or is it really just somebody's mental delusion? That would be considered, could be considered hate speech. So it sounds at first, or to the, I would say the uninitiated, that this seems fairly reasonable, except for hate speech. Well, wait a sec. What is hate speech? Hate speech is usually speech that the accuser hates. Doesn't tell you much about what was actually said. Oh, yes, or speeches that constitute harassment. Well, what's harassment? If it's a public speech, how is anybody being harassed? First of all, nobody has to attend it, so you don't have to attend the speech just to get upset. So you're not being harassed. The speaker has no way of corralling an audience and dragging you off the campus quad unwillingly and forcing you to listen. How could a speech be harassment? Well, believe me, the snowflakes would be able to figure out a way. Near the end of her article, she repeats the same thing about the limitations. She's in favor of not having people be platformed. But she again repeats near the end here. Some members of the academic communities contend that violent, even illegal measures, for example, pulling fire alarms to disrupt talks by speakers with harmful opinions, are preferable to giving them a platform to spread their ideas. In other words, diverting resources from real emergencies would be acceptable in order to shut down offensive expressions that are not hate speech. So, merely ideas that some people dislike would be okay to be heard. But, of course, not hate speech. And I come right back to, but what is hate speech? Well, I'm going to read something written, actually, it's hard to believe it's this long ago, 42 years ago, by the late Dr. William Pierce. And this is called The Buying of Mr. Churchill. Now, I grew up with a very favorable opinion of the World War II British leader, Winston Churchill. In fact, when he died, and I would admit this today, and I've told the story before, so it's not really telling tales out of school, but when he died in 1965, I was so upset. I cried a few tears. I was a teenager back then. And I even went all the way down to downtown Toronto, the British consulate, on public trans, and signed a condolence book. And I called him the greatest Englishman of them all. I think that was original with me. It's certainly I've heard it from other people, and whether it was original or not, that's what I believe. And it would take several decades for me to change my mind that far from being the greatest Englishman of them all, he was a disaster. Well, anyway, this is William Pierce's take on him, this is written in 1977. The Buying of Mr. Churchill. The man most directly responsible for the demise of the British Empire and its replacement as a world power by the Soviet Empire is Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill, 1874 to 1965. The policies which he advocated as a member of the British government in the period just before World War II, and the policies which he followed as Prime Minister during that war, were diametrically opposed to the interests of the British people, and led ultimately to the sad plight in which Britain finds herself today. Churchill acted as he did because he consciously and deliberately served alien interests from 1938 at the latest until the end of the war. Now that's a very charge that also David Irving has made, that Churchill was essentially bought or blackmailed or both by foreign powers. We're going to get to who those are. Churchill once said that I was not did not become a parliamentarian to preside over the breakup of the British Empire, but that is exactly what his wartime policies and the deal he had to make in order to keep Britain in that war. That's exactly what the result of those policies. By the time he died in 1965, the British Empire had been completely dissolved, with the exception of Hong Kong and a few islands. Writes Dr. William Pierce, Winston Churchill was the descendant of a noble family, the son of Lord Randolph Churchill, who was the third son of the 7th Duke of Marlborough. As a young man, Winston was a dilettante who early developed a lifelong taste for expensive clothes, imported cigars, old brandy, and other amenities of the good life. Although he enjoyed a brief and desultory stint as a newspaper correspondent in his early 20s, he soon decided that he could more readily support the style of life to which he wished to become accustomed by claiming a place for himself at the public trough. At the age of 26, he entered Parliament. As a politician, young Churchill continued his dilettante ways, serving in a number of minor posts and switching from one party to another whenever he thought such a move would further his career. I think he started as a Liberal, became a Conservative, and left the party several times. Although he displayed only minimal qualities of statesmanship, his family connections and his sharp eye for the main chance led to a steady advancement, and in 1908 he was promoted to the Cabinet. When World War I broke out, Churchill became First Lord of the Admiralty, with the job of supervising the British Navy. In the latter post, Churchill's lack of a mature sense of responsibility and his ineptness as a military strategist led to a disaster. He directed the utterly bungled Gallipoli campaign against the Turks in 1915, which led to a total defeat of the British with more than 100,000 casualties, and not just the British. They were using as their shock troops there the ANZAC troops. Those are the ones raised from the British dominions of Australia and New Zealand. Forced to resign his Admiralty post in disgrace, Churchill decided to concentrate his energies on developing his one talent, a gift for theatrical oratory. Spending as much as 6 weeks preparing for a single speech, He would carefully rehearse every intonation and dramatic pause, carefully practice every gesture and facial expression before a mirror. He became a demagogue of rare ability. Neither his disgrace as a military bungler nor his subsequent success as a political spellbinder abated his taste for expensive living, however, and in the period between the First and Second World War, Churchill habitually lived far beyond his means. Finally, in 1938, when he was 64 years old, his creditors prepared to foreclose on him, and he was faced with the prospect of a forced sale of his luxurious country estate and beloved house, Chequers. At this hour of a crisis, a dark and mysterious figure had entered Churchill's life. He was Henry Strakosch, a multimillionaire Jew who had acquired a fortune speculating in South African mining ventures after his family had migrated to that country from Eastern Austria. Strakosch stepped forward, advancing the aging demagogue a loan, in quotation marks, of £150,000 just in time to save his estate from the auctioneer, and then quietly slipped into the background again. Now, £150,000 would be probably the equivalent of well over $1.5 million in today's terms. Strakosch served as Churchill's advisor and confidant, but miraculously managed to avoid the spotlight of publicity, which thenceforth illuminated Churchill's ever-rising political career. Churchill immediately became the sharpest parliamentary critic of his own parties. At that time, he once again switched from the Liberals back to the ruling Conservatives, their policy of détente with National Socialist Germany. He took up the Jewish cry, "De Lande est Germania," Germany must be destroyed, and urged his government in a series of jingoistic and bloodthirsty speeches to join the Jewish holy war against Hitler. This was the same Churchill who, in September 1937, had said of Hitler, "If our country were defeated, I hope we would find a champion as indomitable to restore our courage and lead us back to our place among nations." What he really believes, hard to know. I mean, he's saying things that are quite respectful. Hitler in 1937, a year or two later, he completely switched. Churchill's relationship with Jews changed markedly during his political career. In the 1920s and early 1930s, he was not afraid to criticize Jews occasionally or to praise Hitler. But after receiving £150,000 from Henry Strakosch in 1938, he thenceforth uttered only the most extravagant praise for Jews and the most vitriolic condemnations of Hitler and Germany. Even as early as 1920, however, Churchill was careful to salt his criticism of bad Jews and their destructive activities with obsequious references to good Jews and their supposed benevolence. And he wrote a very famous article, "Zionism versus Bolshevism, a struggle for the soul of the Jewish people," by the Right Honorable Winston S. Churchill. And this was written on February 8th, 1920, for the Sunday Herald. And he was commenting on the revolution in Russia, blaming it on bad Jews, these are the international Jews, as opposed to the good Jews. In the Illustrated Sunday Herald of February 1920, this article roused the Jews to a fury against Churchill because it exposed communism as a Jewish plot for world domination. Churchill's praise of Zionism and his erroneous attribution of Christian morals and philosophy to Jews did little to solve their outrage, though it's also interesting that all the while he was a firm supporter of Zionism, which was very much a minority opinion through much of those years. Churchill's praise of Zionism and his erroneous attribution of Christian morals and philosophy to Jews did little to salve the Jewish outrage. It's difficult to decide whether the rose-colored view of Zionism expressed there is due to naivety or hypocrisy. Perhaps he genuinely believed that Zionism was a movement in harmony with the truest interests of the British Empire, rather than an alternative Jewish plot for world domination, fully as evil and dangerous as communism. Perhaps not. In any event, it's clear that despite the fulsome Jew fawning of the first few paragraphs of his article, Churchill was issuing a thinly veiled warning to Jews in Britain: behave, or else repudiate the communist activities and doctrines of your fellow Jews, and help us keep the communist menace from taking over Britain, or we'll all know whom to blame. So this is what makes it doubly annoying and disappointing that on some level Churchill had a fairly unblinkered view of Jews, or at least their role behind communism, or the role, let's say, of some Jews behind communism. And it was argued then, is pretty much irrefutable today, that communism in Soviet Russia was largely a Jewish creation. And continuing, and Dr. William Pierce's article here. And as soon as Churchill changed his tune toward Hitler, the dark forces behind the scenes, which had ignored him for 23 years, began pulling the right strings for him again. In September 1939, immediately upon Britain's declaration of war against Germany, largely as a consequence of Churchill's insistent demagogic oratory, he was again made First Lord of the Admiralty, the very post from which he had been forced in disgrace 24 years earlier. Talk about irony. This time, however, Churchill's reckless disregard for British lives and British welfare was to cost far more than the 100,000 casualties of his first fling at grand strategy. In May 1920, the strings were once again pulled, and Churchill became Prime Minister when Neville Chamberlain stepped down. Britain and her empire were now his to expend as profligately as he wished in the service of his new masters, and expend them he did. His sole aim was the destruction of Germany, regardless of the cost to Britain. This aim, dictated by the Jews he served, was poorly concealed behind a mask of false idealism. Churchill's ostensible motive was in urging the declaration of war against Germany in September 1939 had been the protection of Poland from the German aggression. And his parliamentary rhetoric on behalf of the poor Poles was loud and eloquent. When the Soviet Union invaded eastern Poland later the same month and seized the eastern half of it, Churchill angrily denounced those critics who suggested that his own arguments for a declaration of war against Germany applied equally well now to a British declaration of war against the Soviets. Obviously, Churchill had no intention of using the sauce for the goose as sauce for the gander, even though they were the communists about whose menace he warned 20 years before. Churchill repeatedly rejected peace offers from Germany in 1940 and 1941, even siding with the Labour members of the cabinet against his own party when other conservatives in the cabinet wanted to end the war. You know, that he was never in favor of peace. And peace early on in the war would have entirely changed the history of the war and the world. For one thing, almost certainly, the British Empire would have been saved, because a part of the price of American support for Britain's foolhardy war was that they give up their empire. Now, and that, incidentally, was also the position of the communists. Interesting, and went entirely against what Churchill claimed, and that was he was not going to preside over the disillusionment, the dissolving of the British Empire. But that is, of course, precisely what he did do. Hitler, unlike the rhetoric of the time, had not intended to conquer the world, wasn't trying to conquer all of Europe, and was no enemy of the British Empire. In fact, he repeatedly urged the Churchill that if Churchill agreed to peace, Britain could keep their empire. In fact, you know, it was almost a way of dividing up some of the world. Britain keeps its empire, and Germany would have a free hand to go against the Soviet Union. It was an eminently fair offer, which Churchill, of course, serving other masters, turned down. And it would have saved tens of thousands of British lives and might well have preserved the British Empire. It was certainly not Hitler's intention to dissolve the British Empire. Anyway, back to the essay by Dr. William Pierce. Churchill repeatedly rejected peace offers from Germany in 1940 and 1941, even siding with the Labour members of the cabinet against his own party when the Conservatives in the cabinet wanted to end the war. This was a coalition cabinet, or a unity cabinet. When Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess, flew to England on a solo peace mission in May 1941, Churchill had him immediately arrested and held incommunicado. Hess remained in solitary confinement for 46 more years. He died at age 93 in August of 1987. Churchill was a participant in the wartime strategy conferences with Roosevelt and Stalin, at which a new division of the world's territory and resources was mapped out. In this division of the spoils of war, Britain was sadly shortchanged, but Churchill was unperturbed. With a big cigar clenched in his teeth and suffused with the warm glow of expensive brandy, he merely flashed his two-finger victory sign, and his media cheering section waxed ecstatic about his statesmanship. Whatever he was now beyond criticism, and this included his utterly cynical acquiescence in the handing over of Poland to Stalin after the war, thus revealing once again the hypocrisy of his avowed war aim in 1939 to safeguard Poland's freedom. That's never what it was about. One of Churchill's last acts of so-called statesmanship on behalf of the Jews, it was his insistence on the massive Anglo-American terror raid on Dresden in February 1945, a hate-inspired act of Jewish vengeance against the German people, which cost the lives, and Dr. Pierce says 200,000, the more recent estimates put it between 300,000 and half a million, men, women, and children, and served no military purpose whatsoever. In the post-war years, the sun set on one portion after another of the British Empire, and the entire process of disintegration was set in motion by Churchill in his reckless disregard of British interests during the seven-year war period, 1938 to 1945, when he served an alien master. Yet the establishment history texts continue to heap lavish praise on Churchill, extolling his greatness. If there's anything truly remarkable that Winston Churchill should be remembered for, it is his success in raising the question, raising the price of treason from 30 pieces of silver to 150,000 pounds sterling. I think a very good essay and good introduction to Winston Churchill. Well, the elections for the European Parliament were a big success yesterday for nationalist parties and in England, the upstart Brexit Party, that's only been going for 6 weeks, roared to 29 seats, from nothing to 29. The Liberal Democrats got 16, the Labour got 10, unchanged. The Greens picked up a couple of seats, they got 7. The Conservatives lost 11 seats and reduced to 4, and several of the minor parties got a few. This is a stunning defeat for the mainstream mainline parties, and that was England. Across Europe, nationalists and anti-immigration and Eurosceptics picked up a number of seats. There is now no solid majority. The old kind of ruling coalition, where the center left parties and the center right parties. The Social Democrats took a serious drubbing. They lost 45 seats. The center right party lost 41 seats. Across Europe, but particularly in France and in Germany and in Italy, particularly Italy, the nationalists did extremely well. And this is going to change the dynamics within the new European Parliament. And this is all to the good. So the nationalists and the Eurosceptics have picked up a considerable number of seats, and have denied essentially a working majority to what you might be called the same old game. I'm having some trouble, unfortunately, with my internet reception. So I'm going to have to change computers here for the next item. And videographer Lauren Southern has produced a new movie about open borders. It starts off quite dramatically with her in just off the in Turkey, observing some people smuggling that was going on. Anyway, the interesting thing about this movie is that it was. It is being almost immediately banned by YouTube. And I think we should not for 1 minute forget the absolutely malignant role played by some of these media near monopolies. And that's exactly what it is. YouTube has banned all sorts of good stuff. Which is not only unfair to the people banned, but it's also unfair to the very large YouTube audiences. And the name of Lauren Southern's movie is Borderless. And she's reacted very nimbly to the fact that it was almost immediately banned or deplatformed by YouTube. And she writes, after YouTube took this video down, we launched an emergency DVD pre-order at, and this is a website, where you can order this as a DVD. The internet censors can't come into your home and take it off your shelf, at least not yet. We're working on printing DVDs as soon as possible, and it will come with an uncut extended edition and a ton of bonus features. So if you are interested in getting a copy of Borderless, a DVD copy, just go to, just email me and I'll let you I will give you the particulars, or you can go on our immigration reform website, and it's Canada First, and this is where you find it, Canada First, all one word, canadafirst.nfshost.com, canadafirst.nfshost.com, and you can see the video. We've got the URL there, but if you'd like to order a DVD copy, a hard copy, the particulars are there as to how you can go about doing this. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my musical break, and because I'm having internet access trouble with one of my computers, I'm going to play a CD, which I hope you will like, and this is some of the Hank Williams Jr.'s Jr. classics. Hank, of course, grew up in the shadow of a very famous man, Hank Sr., and in his early days, even as a child performer, he was frequently asked to play, basically to do some of his father's repertoire. But as over the years, he became an artist in his own life, or sorry, in his own right. And here's some of Hank Williams Jr. Works, which I hope you'll like. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
Can't survive. Country folks can't survive. Cause you can't stop a sound and you can't make a run. But put the cold boy in, don't shotgun. They're from North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive.
Williams Jr., Country Boy Can Survive. Listen to a number of Hank's songs. Williams Jr. always has a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
Hank Williams Jr., The Pressure's at Home. One more song I've heard. All my rowdy friends, to Hank Williams Jr. Well, this is Paul Farmer. You're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated today in the morning, 4 in the afternoon, all those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign up tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.
In days of yore, from Britain shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle shamrock.